Hello, I'm Arnold Hamilton, editor of the Oklahoma Observer.
And I'm Marianne Martin, and this is ObserverCast, your weekly deep dive into Oklahoma politics and policy,
presented by the Mary Lou Lemon Foundation. I want you to hold for just a moment two seemingly opposing ideas in your head at the same time. One is that we have a record number of money to appropriate this year. There's been a lot of drama surrounding that appropriations process, more than usual. Always behind closed doors, that's nothing new. And tomorrow should technically be sine die, but we're still trying to figure out a budget and we have a special session for it. So on the one hand, we have a record number of dollars to appropriate. And on the other hand, the Republican supermajority continues to sit on at least $1 billion of that money. So what does that mean? It means that we have a lot of opportunity to do great things for core services in the state of Oklahoma that are continuing to be left undone. It means, as Representative Trish Ranchin said on the floor, as they discussed the budget that finally came to the floor, we're only appropriating about 85% of the budget when typically we appropriate 95, if not more. And why are we sitting on that $1 billion? Well, what stuck out to me on that, that question and answer was when Representative Heffner spoke up, first term House of Representatives. The dog is joining us. She spoke up and she asked about the provider rates that had been increased last year as part of efforts to decrease or at least try to eliminate the DDSD wait list. And were those at jeopardy and what they were going to do about that. And of course, Representative Chairman Wallace kind of punted on that, tossed it over to Representative Lawson, who is the House A&B Subcommittee Chair for Human Services, who said, well, we'd need $70 million to do that. Hey, no, remember, there's $1 billion left if they really wanted to do something with it. So we decided to see if Representative Heffner would talk with us about this issue. It's something that she knows a lot about. It directly impacts her life. And she's been a fantastic advocate for this issue for many reasons. And so we're very grateful for the first time to have Representative Ellen Heffner with us today. So we always start tonight, I guess, and it's end of a long week at the Capitol. So thank you so much for squeezing us in. Tell us a little bit about yourself and, your background and what you do.
Thank you. Thank you for... It's nice to meet you. I've used this line the whole session and that I'm new here. So a lot of those questions, I'm going to speak like I'm new here to the process behind the doors, whereas for 18 years, I did quite a bit of advocating on the other side. So as an advocate for adults and kids with disabilities and working with some really great women, mostly women that I worked with that were advocates and moms of kids who had a disability, that we really learned a lot about disability process, the policy for disability process through with the state, and a lot about the budget process as well. And so on the other side of the doors, it's pretty much the same behind the doors, is that there's a lot of stuff we don't know. And I can say that I'm new and I'm a freshman. I'm also in the minority party. But I also hear from some other representatives on the other side of the aisle that may not be freshmen, been there a couple of years, and they don't know as well. So that was something that was always concerning to me as an advocate. And as a representative, I'd like to know more about that process, being a representative. But as I'm a mom of three, my youngest William, who has an IDD, and he just graduated from high school. So even though this is my first session, I'm trying to really focus with him and be present as he finishes the last year of graduating from a really great school where he's had friends and experiences that he can feel what it's like to go be doing something new. And so I'm really thankful to be present for that. And then trying to catch up at night on all this other great stuff, being part of the 59th legislature.
So, you know, I know throughout session, you have been the voice for this community. And we've had, you know, Wanda Felty on before to talk about the DDSD list and everything, you know, just a fantastic advocate for this. You know, so kind of tell us what your experience has been through this session when this issue comes up, specifically the DDSD waitlist.
So I heard from, like, there's a whole bunch of rumors and gossip out there. And I heard that it came back to me that as being a strong advocate for disability, that that was going to, you know, I was just going to, I wasn't going to be effective because I knew too much about a small thing. And I think that, I don't think that that's been something that has made me ineffective. I think it's been very effective because we put money into, that's our job, is to balance budget and give insight to listen to agencies and try to figure out where our budget's going to be and where we put money. And when we listen to the agencies, the heads of the agencies may not hear what's going on where families are with caregivers or families are with caseworkers or all that. So my voice is pretty important that they know that I'm one of those consumers of that. My son is as well. And so understanding that trickle down process with money and are we doing what we want with the money that we're giving to DDS services or even more specific, the waiting list. I will say that through the budget, when the GA bill went up, got up there, general appropriations, three times I heard about the waiting list on the floor from other representatives. And that's fantastic because that's really never happened before where they're actually, even though there's a historical amount of money, we hear historical a lot, but there's a whole lot of money that was put last year. We still know it's a need. And that I've heard that in arguments with, we have so much money, why are we leaving this still sort of hanging? And so I think that it has been effective for members to come and talk to me about it, have real relationships as friends now and growing from, you know, just being members to, they know my family and I know their families. And I think that that can always make better policy if we start talking about what works and what doesn't work. So I think it's been effective. It hasn't been effective in getting more money towards providers. But I will say Representative Lawson, I respect him. He is an excellent leader, excellent chairman of Human Services A&B. He was the one that from the beginning, as Representative Martinez said, we should have been talking about the budget. You know, they've been talking about the budget for a long time. We have been talking about the budget for a long time. Representative Lawson, Chairman Lawson, understands that we need that, that we need a provider rate. He said it, 70 million. We know the number. We know that we should do it, but that's not the decision that was made. And so in that, but I think it was important that we heard on the floor that that number 70 million comes up. Representative Wallace heard it, and maybe that's something that we can revisit. And I don't have any answers about why it wasn't funded.
Was it just me, or I just sort of felt like after last year that there was some kind of sense that we had solved the problem, that this thing.
I think that's what it appeared.
Well, and the governor, you know. The governor threw it into one of his top 10 promo, you know, sloganeering moments and said, boy, you know, we're going to be top 10 in this within 2 years. And I realize that's only a year now of the 2 years, but it doesn't look to me like we've really moved the ball forward very much this year. It looks like we're more in a holding pattern, which again, given the, I'll use the word too, historic revenue situation. We've never had what we have right now in Oklahoma. And this is a golden opportunity missed as far as I'm concerned.
So there's, gosh, so many it's really hard to it's really hard to stay glass half full. That's I like staying glass half full. Disappointment comes on of, you know, not that they have to listen to me, but there is a lot of data there that we have available, not coming from Department of Human Services. That's been pretty opaque, not transparent. I've definitely struggled with trying to get numbers, and I'm still waiting for numbers. But the whole idea of solving a wait list, I think it, if we want to just put it, what I think that that was, is that they were very good at getting a bunch of money and attention last year. And they did that. What we didn't realize was that the structure was not available to receive all that money. And so for me, as the real story on it, watch PBS NewsHour. Judy Wirjip did an excellent interview, and you'll get to see me do an ugly cry.
Cool.
But I know that, like, the July after that money was talked about, I said, I think we're putting the cart before the horse, which is what we do, is that we aren't asking the families, how is it working? You know, and when my son just got off the waiting list, he had an emergency waiver. My son has seizures that cause him to stop breathing now. We don't know why that changes. So here, this is my first session. I also have that to do it. Mm-hmm. And so when he got the emergency waiver was back in January, when I actually received the HTS, the caregiver, so that I could do my job and try to be focused, single parent, was 10 weeks later. That's not emergency. And a lot of it has to do with the same thing with Social Security. If we want to go federal, you know, I'd love to have a meeting about how do we modernize this program, all of it, so that we can look at where families are. I'm a single mom. I work 9 to 9 p.m. sometimes during session. And the weekends, let's talk. I have all the time in the world for you. But that's not when caseworkers work. So I get put as that I'm, you're not answering my emails. You're not responding. You're not interested. Are those families being taken off the waiting list? And so these are why the numbers from DHS are very, very important, is because who's waited 15 years? We waited 15 years because he was removed and then put back on for some unknown reason.
Oh my gosh. But
if I'm waiting for a service for 15 years, why in some of their data do they say they don't want services anymore, or we can't find them? When 2 years prior, we did that list and cleaned up that list, why can't we find them? Sometimes I hear, and I don't know if it's rumor or whatever, that they haven't responded. Well, I know that those that English is their second language get material in the form of English, not Spanish. So is that also a reason that people are not getting those services? So I just think that because the structure wasn't ready for this influx of families' need, we not only put a lot of burden, right now they're putting a lot of burden on families. When I got off that emergency list and I called, they said, we don't have any caregivers. You know, agencies don't have any HTS people to hire. And so they asked me if I would quit my job. They didn't know that I had knocked over 8,000 doors to get the job that I have, but we're putting that burden back on families to find someone to watch their child. And if we can't find one, we have parents quitting their jobs so that they can get paid to watch their child. But we know that that ends with more, you know, down the road, we know that the caregiving crisis, it's real when parents don't get a break. And my son is not as high medical, but there are families that cannot find people to help them. So to relieve that. So we have started a mystery list of all these people that are waiting. We get off the list and we're so excited, but now we're waiting for someone that we can pay to watch our child. So there's so much internal stuff beyond this. I mean, we could spend hours talking about it. Because everyone's going, oh my gosh, this is way more than we thought we were going to call you about, Rep. Hefner. But It's a lot. So why is that provider rate important that we raise it? We know that we need to pay people more to take care of our vulnerable adults. That's human capital.
So the providers that you're, I'm sorry, I just want to make sure we clarify a few things. So the providers you're talking about, like those are the home health providers, the folks that come out, right? It's not necessarily the doctors, but it's the folks that you need to hire to make sure your son is safe and healthy.
Yeah, there's different names for it. Direct support provider is one. I know that on the Medicaid side, Oklahoma Healthcare Authority has providers. They did get, I think that bill is going to, tomorrow we vote on that, but they got a little bit of a raise for the ICFs and the assisted living nursing homes. They need, or they're going to close those doors, which do have some of the families, I mean, some of the adults, the Oklahomans that I, that have an intellectual development, developmental disability. What I'm talking about are these habilitation training specialists, which are supposed to, with these waivers, help my son become, what are those supports he needs to help him become more independent?
Out of a home, out of an institution.
Which can also do a couple of things. So it can help William become more independent before these seizures started. We really were on that track for him to be more independent, you know, away from me. Now we have a little bit more, you know, the HTS sometimes has to let William rest. He takes a lot of naps. He's on a high amount of medication right now. Mm-hmm. So our service plan kind of changed, our plan of care has changed a bit, but we hope, you know, that we're working towards to trying something to fit better for him, but thank goodness for that HTS. This Jared is his name. And we only found Jared because, you know, we're in community. But Jared has saved William's life twice now since he's been with William. And we want to pay him $12. Yeah. It's that idea that we are holding onto this money and we're a pro-life state. I think this is a pro-life issue. I think these are the kids that the adults that we need to show that the 32.5 million, half of what it went, some of it went to a provider rate last year, others went to clearing the waiting list. It's a $200 million problem to me. You know, if we just keep funding that, we are so behind in taking care of families. We need to keep putting more money. And what money we did put in, someone said, aren't you happy they gave $10 million to the waiting list? And they should, because we're behind. That just keeps up with the FMAP.
And that wasn't even the full amount that was needed to fully fund it, right? I mean, so, okay, again, I kind of want to touch.
I go all over the place.
No.
I could blame that it's ended.
Let's unpack a few things. And so just to lay it out clear for folks that, you know, why this is such an atrocious omission, I guess, right, by the state legislature, when this is something that we can quantify, we know what needs to be done. We also happen to have the money to do it, right? Like we have the money to do it. Representative Petter, I just want to make sure, you know, like I do understand the complexity of your situation. I had a daughter who had cerebral palsy, and then she was a cancer patient, you know, and so all those things that you have to do, not nearly quite as dire as seizures, but, you know, and she could function independently, but just the complexity of that life, caring for your child, that it's just, you really can't tell the story and have people think it's real. Like it just, I think people would really, would just be in disbelief at how complex and when you say, like, they say, well, why don't you quit your job? Like you can just do that. Right. And so, just to kind of pull apart this a little bit, so folks really understand. So, you know, they appropriated that money last year and then they didn't have the providers. This is what you're saying, right? They didn't have the providers that could then do the job that they had set aside money for.
Nowhere near. Yeah.
And then they asked parents like you, and caregivers like you, then you should just quit your job. And so then that takes people out of the workforce. And, you know, as a parent who has been in that situation where it was my full-time job to take care of my kid, like, you know, wow, like if that's really our solution, right? We're, you know, hobbling a portion of our workforce because we can't take care of it otherwise. And then I'm like just trying to think of like, there's just all these issues that you've brought up that just kind of touch on so many failures of the way that they budget. And I was talking to my husband about this yesterday and I was like, you know, I mean, it just goes back to a budget is a moral document.
It's, you know, there's so much that's attached to it. You know, the good thing is we're not on the other side just saying, can we please have $1 million? Cause that's what we used to do before.
Yeah.
You know, Wanda and Roseanne. So yeah. You know that Aaron, all of them, that's all we would do is we're so grateful for $1 million, which took care of this many people. Now we have money. And someone told me, oh my gosh, it's just as hard if you have a lot of money in the state to how to give out. And I'm thinking, we could write that check. You know, that is something, yeah. But here's also what we don't have. Again, I have to say, we don't have the structure. My battery's going to run out pretty soon. We don't have the structure to handle that, but there are things that we can do that advocates have asked the agency to do. So instead I ran for office and I'm kind of doing some of that behind the scenes, working towards trying to find a designation for that HTS. There's career techs. There's people that can leave school that'll go, I could get paid maybe $15 an hour that I could take care of and be a caregiver. Our elderly would need it. That's going to be a huge hole. So having our career techs have that job designation, so we give them a place that they can go to the next step, maybe a CNA, maybe they want to go into, but anyway that they have some experience so that's just not nothing, which is what that job gives you, is you don't get any sort of credentials. I'll give Jared a great, what is it called? A recommendation.
Yeah.
But what we really need is something that says, this is a good job and it's worth it to take care of someone. This is something that's meaningful. So Representative Lawson and I are talking about that. How do we work with career tech? So that's one thing, because we can't solve a problem if we're not putting the pieces in place to take care of that. And so, I mean, if anything, there's a success is all the conversations about what we need, what we should have done when we were asking for the money, instead of just saying the success was getting the 32.5. The success is that when a parent gets off, we can say, we can call you at the time that you need and work out paperwork and do it the way that we can, sometimes on a phone instead of a laptop or faxing things. Who faxes things anymore? Let's take the language out of families when we talk to families and say, you're off the list. It's going to be real hard in the beginning, real hard in the beginning. Why? Why does it have to be difficult? Why can't we use some of the modern things that we can sign things through digital instead of using paper or fax? As a financial advisor that we do when I do financial transactions through this laptop or phone. Why aren't we doing that for families? And so all these questions are coming up, but I'm not getting any response from the agency. I don't want to be someone that they go, oh my gosh, she's an activist. I heard that about me. No, I want to help families. And, and if families feel like they can't do it, they're not getting it in the language that they use, and we drop them off, we are not doing them any good. We're not doing our Oklahomans any good listening.
And the thing is like what I know for a fact, because I have worked in the agencies and I've worked at the Capitol, is DHS knows, OHCA knows that you cannot just send someone one mailer, not even in their native tongue, and expect them to respond. Right? Oh my gosh, what is this? So I mean, you cannot just send out mail from a state agency that people don't necessarily know or trust, and think that's going to be enough to get them to respond, right? Like they have closed down access points, specifically with DHS, and the health departments and DHS. So it's just that much harder to have the field work, to have any sort of field work, any sort of field contact, to get a hold of those families. So, I mean, I'm so intrigued by what you're telling me about how they're saying, well, these people just, we can't find them. I don't know that they're trying, right? Because if you just send out those mailers, especially if they're not in their native language.
So
they know this.
So I think that the goals that we have to look at are different. They have to be not that as much as the agency's goals, they have like a 2-year thing. They think they're going to get through the waiting list.
Yeah.
I told in a meeting, I told one of the directors, I said, let's just stop it. Let's put a pause on this for a minute. Instead of going through each cohort and contacting each one of them, let's just get through a cohort. And if there's some struggle in getting people the services they need, we may have some outliers. But until we get through those cohorts, let's not start another one.
Yeah.
What we're doing then is we're just saying, okay, we checked the box on that one. We got the Smith family. Oh, they didn't respond. No, let's care for the families that have been waiting for 15 years that already have a distrust with the agency.
Yeah.
It was born out of a lawsuit. It's born out of a wait. We have to understand where the families are, because the background of my life is chaos. I would say that the background of my life is chaos. And I had someone from the agency say, well, you dress up and you look nice. Oh, but that's so that I can do my job. That's my thing that I do. What the community help that I get, or the family help that I get after my husband passed away, thank goodness, or I wouldn't have been able to do it. But we can't rely on that for other families. They don't. They isolate themselves.
They don't have it.
They don't have it. And so we have to understand that that's sort of the families that we're talking to, that it's not a one and done. And if we...
It's not easy. And it, I mean, even if you get in contact for that first time, like I can just remember what it was like trying to get my daughter's dyslexia diagnosis and then some sort of treatment, therapy, remediation for it. Just having to navigate that alone. With any sort of complex diagnosis or special health needs or complex health needs. You know, I'm just lucky that I had a job where I can make phone calls during the day, you know, check my emails, and just hunt things down. Cause that's literally what you have to do a lot of times. Cause you don't get handed information that helps you go to the next step. You don't always get handed off to the next person, you know, when you're going from one thing to the next, and then all the hoops that you have to go through, specifically with qualifying for disability / getting handed off to TEFRA. I mean, all those steps, I mean, it literally is like a bureaucratic nightmare. I understand the logic behind it, you know, and we're totally for the public sector pro-state services, right? But I mean, for people who don't have means and don't have social networks and don't have communities that help them through all these things, you know, they don't know, if you don't know how to have those conversations or to press for answers. I mean, it really is impossible. So you just think of, yeah, maybe they can't find them because they're not trying, right?
Yeah, it's, so you had mentioned a couple of my friends that I've known
for
years, and the Friday before session started, here, I thought that I had this idea that, okay, I'm going to have, I was way ahead because I knew of two people I could hire to help me with William so I could go to work, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was way ahead of a lot of other people because we talked about the caregiving whole, the crisis there. And I was talking to, you know, there's so many people that call you or you don't know who they are. They know bits and pieces about you and given some quite a bit of wrong answers.
You're repeating yourself ad nauseum.
And then given wrong information. Mm-hmm. So I call, I'm sitting in my car and it was about to walk into some, you know, big freshman, you know, you have to go in there looking all nice and meeting people to, you know, before this session started. And I'm in my car crying. Because I get off the phone with someone that works at DHS that just gave me a whole bunch of misinformation. And I made the decision that there is no way that I could, that this, the two HTS were going to be in place so that I could go to work. And I call my friend and I just said, I give up. Like, I got to find something else. I'll pay them. That's what I said. I'll pay him. And if you know what a state legislator makes, mm-hmm. you know, I'll pay him. He can live with us or whatever, and we'll just figure it out. And then of course, my friend said, okay, we'll take some nights and we'll figure it out. And I had a lot of friends come in. Again, not a lot of people have that. But if I know like the two people in the state of Oklahoma that know more about waivers and about the HISM and why the waivers got started and how they're supposed to work, and I'm crying And I know as much as they do, but I'm in crisis right now. You know, this, you can't really think and everything's, and they said, we'll get you through this, which they did. It took another 3 weeks to get someone in the home. And they were with me the whole way. But if that's if I know a lot about it and I was about ready to give up, think about all those other families. And it kept ringing in my head, it's only hard in the beginning. Why? Why don't we work at the part of what can we make different so that we can help families? And that's part of everything I talk about. We're not even talking about the budget now. There are systemic things that are wrong within agencies and how we work. If it worked well in the 70s, it's definitely not going to work well here. It's not. And no other agency, as a legislator, they give us new laptops just to, you know, whatever. We are up to date with security and all that other stuff for a reason. And so I don't know why we can't make those tweaks, number one. Number two, I think a family has to be a part of the process whenever you do something new, because I think it's how you receive the information. And I think that was a big chunk that was left out this last, you know, with DHS on helping. We can't just say that it's rah-rah. Every time I saw those commercials, they were coming out more and more. When I'm in my car crying, like totally going through crisis. And it was almost like gaslighting that they were like, this is great. Everyone's getting off the list and you see other families. And I'm like, I can't, it's not happening. And I'm about ready to start a job that I have no idea what I'm walking into. And I got to support my family. I'm worried about my son, those seizures. Think about all this chaos that's behind me. The only reason that I feel like I can actually do it now is because there's a whole bunch wrong with me being self-directed services and the employer. I don't have time. I always tell Jared, you're going to get paid. I don't know if I'm going to actually get everything in the way I'm supposed to, because I took on another job so I could pay Jared to watch my child with self-directed services. Aside from that, the only reason I feel great is because Jared likes my son. William likes Jared, the HTS. I know he can save William's life. So that sort of drops my shoulders that I can trust him. Again, that's one person. There are a lot of families that don't have that. And I know that a lot of families aren't going to find perfect, but what is the percentage? 80% of adults or children who have intellectual developmental disabilities in a group home or in nursing or assisted living are sexually abused. Mm-hmm. We are not putting people close to the people that are vulnerable in a good spot. It's just like, there's so much wrong with the system. And so I think that if it starts at, we can find a way to help families find people for that are there, the pipeline of the jobs, paying them quality money. Letting families take a break. If I am the employer, I need a break. I mean, I need a break too, you know? So why not show that with the amount of money that we have to help families? It is what Oklahomans are good at. That's the Oklahoma standard. I've heard families so many times on the floor. This is how we help protect families. Because, you know, if we're not helping them, there is a lot of divorce. It's just a problem. Awkward. So I know I'm blowing it all up and everyone thinks the world. No. I will tell you, I will not stop talking about it and I will make friends. I know people are listening, not the people who are writing the big checks. And I think that I heard when I heard, oh, no, no, they I heard this was gossip. I heard, oh, no, no, we're going to do that next year.
So first of all, I'm just aghast that anyone thought you wouldn't be taken seriously because of your lived experience of, as you know, a parent of a child with needs. Like, I mean, to me, that is the ultimate capital talk, right? To discourage you from doing what you do. But then, I mean, the core issue keeping the state of Oklahoma from being top 10 at almost anything is the fact that we do not treat the systemic issues behind poverty, for one, and all of our poor determinants of health, right? So again, you as a parent who knows how to navigate the system, and yet you still hit the walls, right? you still hit the walls. You still have to, like, you know, make miracles happen to make sure your child receives the care that he deserves. And boy, do I feel that. Oh my gosh. And so we fail to fund any of those things that would get at the heart, because if you can't navigate it, and I've had trouble navigating it, and I'm tenacious and a huge loudmouth, you know, imagine a mother who's like, what is going on with my kids? Or a grandparent, most likely, right? Who's seeing these symptoms in their kids, something's not right. They don't know what's going on, but they don't have access to a pediatrician, a primary care provider, a social worker, a school nurse. They probably have their kid in a classroom that may have 25 to 35 kids in it. You know, I mean, all these other things, they have to worry about feeding their family, keeping the lights on, giving them clothes. You know, those are nothing that our state legislature is willing to tackle. And I mean, so I'm sure, I don't know if you agree, but I'm like, yeah, it's not at all surprising that they're like, oh, well, it would take $70 million, but.
Well, again, Representative Lawson, we've talked about this a lot, and I know that wasn't his decision. You know, he knew, and he had all of the great data to show that that's what we needed. It didn't happen. So, but to move back, there are some good things. So I like to talk about what we're going to do. So things that we should have done before, but we're going to move on now, is that path for caregiving. We know that we need it. So we're going to try to do that with our career techs. And there's been a lot of really great information so far, already doing a work group and trying to get that happen. That is something that can happen within a year. We could get students that don't want to go to college for a long time, but could do a 3 month to understand that first level of caregiving. That's great, because now we have workforce that maybe not be able, that could get paid a nice amount of money to care, that could be, give them on a start of maybe a next step, or just stay there, which would be great. Give them something. That's one thing. Another thing, we're talking about it more. That's good. And I know people are like, that's not enough. I do like to build relationships. I know that when people know that I get on the mic, it's something that has to do with who we're missing in the conversation, which is mostly students who have a disability. That goes with kindergarten through 12, or bills that didn't get heard, which should have been heard, for higher ed. We have a caregiving crisis. What happens when they graduate from high school? We don't give them Oklahoma Promise to go to one of the three programs. That was a bill that I had that was not heard in the Senate side, should be heard. And I'm going to talk about that a lot, because that's one of those things that can help. It's not a lot of money, but it can be that path to get kids off of benefits and to go into a job, and family, friends, and all that other stuff that doesn't leave them excluded. So there's all these different pieces that I've already started to plant seeds with. Building relationships is probably one of those things that I'll say is the best thing that happened, because I find out from people, it's not a secret anymore, that people will come up to me and go, my aunt had a disability, or my son has autism, and things that we don't want to talk about because it's not very popular. You know, Representative Hefner gets up there, Ellen, and says, I have a son, I'm a widow, I got a plan for what happens in community, and our services are going to support him. You guys, you got to help me with this. And they're saying, oh, wait, I know some families too. So that buzz is starting too. Being a member does have its important things too, I think. The money, gosh, I wish it would have happened. But if I just say wish, that's not going to happen. But I know that those conversations have started, and I'm very happy to keep them going. Maybe not this year. And I know we funded other things. I'll still keep having the conversation with the year after too. Do I know how much money we need? No, I would say it's a $200 million problem, but I have no idea. We haven't really looked at it, but I do know that it's something across the United States that we're not taking care of these families, and we need to. Hopefully, especially with all the knowledge that we have and are bringing now, that we can get that really started. We're not just ending the waiting list by just putting money towards it. We're actually putting that structure in place. I think families, listening to families, is really going to help that. So I'm trying to be hopeful and positive, but I know that it's constant conversations and work. And that took a lot of my time this this session, and I do it all over again because I got to meet the other members. Wow. Got to find out some things about them and how we can work together.
You worked it from the advocacy side for so many years, and now you've had one session essentially of experience on the other side of this. But I can't help but wonder, as you're going through all this, as you're talking us through it, that one of the real problems we have in Oklahoma is that our legislature is so cut off from its constituents once it assembles in Oklahoma City. Unlike any other legislature I've ever covered, and I've covered it in other states, my career's been long enough, they have hearings where people come and testify for hours, and there are all these, there's this openness, at least, you know, that the lawmakers are going to sit and actually meet and listen to these folks in forums and going to hear these kinds of stories that make them, that might give them insight into, oh, well, just appropriating that money isn't going to solve the problem. We've got to figure out a way to solve this other problem first, or these other three or four problems first. And I wonder if you think there's any opportunity in this realm to begin to sort of open up the process a little more, so that the mistakes that we continue to make, we throw money at things and think it solved the problem, and it turns out it didn't solve the problem, can actually be resolved. We can actually make progress on these things. If we're listening, if we're really listening, and providing opportunity for our constituents to weigh in and say, well, here's what's happening to me, and I thought I was going to have to quit my job, or I did have to quit my job to take care of my loved one.
I think that that's, yes, that was one thing as an advocate that was really, that was difficult, is that, you know, we hear that word transparent how many times, and the transparency really isn't there when we're not listening to the people who are using the services, or, you know, that it just doesn't make sense. I don't know if you remember years ago, Governor Fallon had put together the Blue Ribbon Panel. And the Blue Ribbon Panel, one of my heroes, he used to work for DDS, Jim Nicholson. I loved the history that he knew, and history sometimes is that great thing that we can know where we've come from. And he had the history of disability in Oklahoma. And when all those agencies would come together and talk about what the families that they knew, caseworkers, and real life stories, they gathered all this information, they came up with something. And then what they did was they pitched it to the executives of all those agencies, who really were, if they were hired as an executive director, they knew how to manage people. Mm-hmm. Right, the workers, but they really didn't know about how some of those programs really helped people. Mm-hmm. And there's that disconnect, you know. And not saying anything against, you have to have someone who manages people well, that's needed, but you also need to have that communication of, is this program really working? So when I used to, I'm a graduate of Partners in Policy Making. I don't know if you guys know that program. The Oklahoma Developmental Disability Council has it, and I've been a graduate, which is why I like to do that, follow the money. So then we know how that is, which is why I love LOFT. I think LOFT is a great job. Mm-hmm. Finding out, are we spending our dollars? As a financial advisor, I like to see that our money is going to paying off the things that it's intended for. Mm-hmm. And so there's our disconnect too. We've seen that with other programs as well. OMES was a big one that LOFT looked at as well. So we do have some sort of thing to say, LOFT is great. Give it something to put those guardrails on. And I'm not for a ton of rules, but to spend the money in the right way. And so there's where looking, is it working with programs? Are we listening to the people? Not necessarily constituents, but users of the things that we're putting money towards would be very helpful. And so if I'm struggling as a consumer, or my son, because he's the one with the waiver, we're really not doing a good job. So I can't give ourselves an A+. We did get the waiver, and I'm not saying taking anything away from that. That's saying after waiting for such a long time, it has changed our life in such a great way. And we could be doing better. Because what we did was just fulfill that promise because there was a lawsuit by him getting that waiver. We can do better. And if it's not working and we're causing more hardship or having people not using what was intended, missing people, struggles, I would say that I'm systemic change, but I'm systems change, but I'm a freshman. But I think we have to be taking tiny small bites out of the elephant. How do we change those things? Look at it and see if it's working. And that's what gives me, like, I want to do this job. I think that being a public servant, it's listening to people and if it's working or not. And of course, I get frustrated when you can't help families, but I know that there's a process. People tell me to be patient, which I am. It's hard to be patient with a lot of money, heard. But I think that every year that I'll have to run again. That's another thing that stresses me out a bit. But I think that it's great for especially in my freshman class, you know, not only the Democrats, but the Republicans, we come from all these different great backgrounds. If you look at our backgrounds, and there's a lot of real hard workers in there. And I think that always helps the legislature if you're willing to do the work and if you're willing to listen. So those are some positives. Even I know if you want me to be negative about it, I can't, because I am very hopeful that what I've received with William, even though it was a lot, I feel for the first time I can trust that I can hear my son out there, that I can be present with you as a legislator and as a parent, if you're interviewing me as a parent, and I don't have to really worry if he's okay. Someone's watching him, and the waiver and those services have done that for me. Hopefully it's put some more years on my life instead of taking him away from stress. And I'm still laughing. And just, I feel that it's all great. The people say this was the worst session ever. I don't know any better because this is my first time. But I do think there's things that we can work on, and I'm not sad or depressed. I'm working on them. I think I'm ready and eager for that. We're just getting started.
I think you and I both know, as parents with kids that need us differently than other parents, that at the end of the day, them being okay means a lot, right? And so all the trials and tribulations at the state legislature, although they unfortunately have a real world impact, I can understand your grace and your patience, because it seems like you can see the forest through the trees, right? So given what you've experienced as a parent. So I really want to thank you for your time tonight. This was a fantastic conversation. I'm so glad you made time for us. We wish you the best of luck. I hope you never lose your optimism through this process, because we do always need that hope.
I do want to thank like the leadership that in our caucus too has given me that sort of, that says, no, your voice is important, which is great. That's a really good feeling. The other people I work with, even on the other side of the aisle, from all parts of Oklahoma, I feel that there's a great reception for that. They've received me in that way of understanding that, and not just looking at me in that maudlin way of, oh, poor Ellen. They're like, oh my gosh, look at her, she's going. But I think that's, I'm very thankful for that as well. I have only great things to think about working with each other, because I think that's best for Oklahoma. That sounds Pollyanna, but something that we used to say with advocates is, especially with my son, the work that we do as advocates, it may not be in my son's timeline, but I know that we are moving towards that better life, you know, that good life. And so it's for other people's timeline as well. So we'll all work together for it.
I hear echoes of Jeannie McDaniel in that.
Oh my gosh, I a lot of love, a lot of love for people who work hard like that. She did.
Yeah. You are definitely in her. I can totally hear her in those words. So thank you so much for your time tonight. Please come back and talk to us again.
Yes. I can't wait till I can talk about something fun. Maybe.
Well, I don't think that's how it ever works out. So I'm sorry to disappoint you that way. It's never fun, although some of us weirdos kind of think this policy stuff is fun. So, but you know, this is not an issue that Arnold and I are going to let slip. We won't forget about it. And we certainly won't.
Thank you. Help me work on this, and I'll. Working together is great, and I appreciate your time as well. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ObserverCast. If you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us and share our episodes far and wide on social media. If you're interested in sponsoring ObserverCast, please give Arnold Hamilton a call at 405-478-8700 or drop him an email at ahamilton@okobserver.org. You can also support ObserverCast with a tax-deductible donation to the Oklahoma Observer Democracy Foundation, whose mission is to help create a better, more informed Oklahoma. And to help keep us on the air, visit okobserver.org and click on the Donate button on the upper right side of the homepage. We also urge you to subscribe to the Oklahoma Observer, now in its 55th year of comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. We have a special digital subscription rate for ObserverCast listeners, only $1.99 a month for the first year. That's 50% off the usual rate for monthly digital subscribers. Just use the coupon code ObserverCast when checking out to get the discount rate. And finally, we want to thank Jared Deck for the music you're listening to in the background here. He's not just a resident of Norman anymore. He is now the Oklahoma State Representative for House District 44. Congratulations, Representative Deck. We're so proud of you. But you can still download his albums at iTunes and learn more, including dates for any upcoming performances at jareddeckmusic.com.